All right. So, Brad, in that first episode that we recorded the other day, like we've only just gotten to know each other. We've had some really wonderful conversations over the past month or two. Something that came up that you brought up that I didn't know about was in your background to lean manufacturing. And yeah. I made a note of it because I felt like, wow, that's, very unique, and awesome and interesting. It's where this all kind of comes from, right? I thought it would be a great episode for a podcast. And then most importantly, I want to know, right? I want to know what I can learn in this conversation about your background with lean manufacturing and your experience of how you transferred into being an agile coach. So do you want to give us just a quick overview about, where you were and what the environment was? Who did you work for? What were you guys manufacturing?
Yeah, I can do that. I worked in several factories. I bounced around a bit. When I first dropped out of college, moved out of my mom's house and moved up to my dad, he worked in the factory and I had relatives that worked at a little factory called Magna Donnelly. And they work in the automotive industry and they specialized in plastic parts. So they did injection molding, and then they also did assembly, which is where I was. So I was there for about 2 years, and then I moved back to my hometown, to Grand Rapids, to go back to college and try to pick up more classes and try to get more into IT, which I always wanted to do, and kind of struggled a little bit with, balancing paying the bills and moving forward in this industry, in this field. So I ended up picking up jobs in steel stamping, food processing, food and pills as well.
That's cool. Okay. So in those roles that you were in, right, what exposure, well, actually, let's ask a different question first. At what point did you become aware of lean manufacturing, right? Because I'm sure that probably you were hired, to do a specific job. And then at some point you became aware of, oh, we're doing something called lean manufacturing.
Yeah. So I definitely didn't immediately kind of draw correlations to lean manufacturing being some big thing. I didn't know it came from Toyota. I didn't know any of the history. As soon as you start in a factory, though, those principles are there and they're starting to teach you those things. So, and especially in assembly. In assembly, we use Kanban. In its, I would say, truest form, right? How Taiji Ono saw it from Piggly Wiggly, where, you have the product on the shelf and then you have the product in the back room and how do you figure out when to fill it? So in the factory, when they would bring parts to the line, they had a little laminated card on the bin of parts for that part type. And then you would take out the card as soon as you pulled the bin in and you would put it in. We called it a mailbox. It was a little plastic bin. And then you had what was called a material handler whose sole purpose was to refill products on the line. And so you may have two or three bins of that type of part on your line at any given time. And the material handler would grab that card and they would know where to go to get more and bring more to your line. So okay,
go on.
I was going to say that's the first real big kind of hey, there's something going on here thing I noticed.
Gotcha. And so what was the point for you when you started to learn the words and the concepts, as opposed to just observing them and being that's really interesting. This is really cool.
Yeah. So what's interesting about it is I feel like I naturally had kind of that optimization waste mindset. And I don't feel like we talked about the words lean a ton. When we did talk about it, it was more like you would tape off areas of the factory and you would have everything had its place. And the lines were very blurred too with Six Sigma. In fact, some people view Six Sigma and lean as being synonymous, and they're really not. They're complementary. But Six Sigma's big thing is DMAIC, which is very waterfall. I would say it's one of my least favorite, I don't know if you can call it methodologies, principles. But the lean stuff has definitely stuck with me. And so when I say I naturally kind of optimized it, I was 19 when I started in the factory. And my very first position was filling grease like into like parts where they connected because they were corroding. So like that was the Band-Aid fix was, oh, let's just put a dab of grease on them. And I had to take a spatula and like put it in a turkey baster by hand and then squeeze it into the parts. And that's all I did all day. And so working on the production line was very glamorous to me in that situation. So I kept bugging and bugging and bugging to get on the line. And I was young and I was athletic. So my first time, I like hit the record, the average that people were putting out. And then my second time, I far exceeded it. And that was just through working really hard. But when I was in the cell, I started to see that like the machines took so long to process a part. And then there was things that you had to manually do to build the part. And just naturally, I started saying, okay, well, the machine runs for X long. What are the things that I can do while I'm waiting for that machine? And I would even argue some of it was like ergonomics, like, okay, I can put these parts together and I can wait and then I can grab the part from the machine. And so I really started eliminating waste just by thinking that way.
Okay, that's really cool. So there's a couple of things that you said in there that I want to call out. I don't want to forget them. I'm taking notes, actually. The first one is, I love what you said, you know, you just felt like it was innate to you, like you were, you know, naturally thought in that way. And like observationally, like great agilists, like tend to say that same sort of thing, right? Like, they were project managers prior and they felt like a fish out of water, which is like my story. Right. Mm-hmm. Just this innate way of like seeing the matrix in flow. Right. And, but we talked also just a little bit the other day, things are escaping my head as fast as they're coming into them today. I apologize. We talked a bit about, I'll get back to it. So the other thing, I wish I had written that down. So the other thing that you said that I wanted to call out is you were talking about your average, right? So what kinds of metrics were in place that you saw back then, you know, that were being used?
Yeah, I talk about this a little bit when I do comparisons in software development and like outcomes versus outputs. And most of the metrics were outputs. The big one is parts per person per hour. And so we would capture how many parts did we make per hour and then how many people were in the production line, or we call them cells because they're more of a cube. How many people were in there? We also kept track of waste, like how many parts did we break, how many parts showed up broken. And so there was a quality element to it as well. And those were really, from my memory, the two major things that we tracked.
Okay. And so, you know, were you guys self-organizing on like, you know, they would give you guys an outcome that they were asking you guys to hit, and you were able to self-organize and solution ideas?
Not so much. So the parts were designed by engineers and then they would create a standard procedure, I'm forgetting the term for it, but SOP is the acronym. So they would write out what they thought the best way was to produce this part and then how many people it required. And then they had stations. And so a station was a set of actions that a person had to do. Now, who worked on what station was something that we as a team decided. And by default, we rotated. So everyone would, in theory, get a turn, except for some of them were more of like the rock star station where it definitely took more skill to really push out the numbers. And so if we were behind on a shipment or something, someone more experienced might step into that role. And our targets were really just, we had shipments that we had to meet. And so they'd be like, you know, you have to build X amount of this part. In order to hit that shipment, you need to build this many parts per hour.
Okay. And this is totally a sidebar, but so that's your cue to stop me from rambling on too much. But have you been watching Andor at all on Disney Plus?
I haven't yet. No. Is it good?
It's actually really good. I'm enjoying it. But there's And this is not really a spoiler, but there's a scene where they're in some sort of prison factory, right? The mm-hmm. inmates have to manufacture parts for the Empire, right? And they're working in like teams of, I think, like 5 or 7 or something like that. And I was thinking to myself, wow, that's kind of like Scrum, you know? And now there was negative incentive, right? Because the team that had the lowest output was going to get like shock therapy treatment or something like that, you know? But for the most part, they had the ability to self-organize around like, you know, who's the person who's holding the rivet gun or the laser or whatever that mm-hmm. is, right? And, you know, who picks the parts, you know, who aligns them. And they, you know, they ran in these cycles. And so I just thought that was kind of interesting, but you haven't watched Sounds Andor, similar. But you should watch it. You should watch it and I'll you should get back to me. You know, one of my big things is I love looking for Scrum and Agile in the wild. Ted Lasso, and I'm going to end it here and I'm gonna get back on track. Ted Lasso to me is one of the greatest stories about Agile ever told, even though it has nothing to do with Agile in the story. You watched it?
Yes. Yeah, I watched it. I watched it twice.
Yeah, I'm so excited for it coming out again. All right, so, you know, like I'm jealous of like your background, right? I was on a call with another coach the other day and they were talking about like impediments and flow and mm-hmm. whatnot. And, you know, they're measuring certain parts of it, but they're not measuring it really end to end. Like they're measuring from like the start of a sprint to the end of a sprint, you know, but the artifacts that flow into a sprint, right? Like, so how long does it take for an epic to become a feature, to become stories, to then mm-hmm. go through the system? And, you know, how long does it take for the epic, you know, to move through a system? How long does it take? They're not doing that, you know? And in like a manufacturing world, like, you know, you just add a tag, right, to an object. There we go. You add a tag to an object. And you could see it move through the system. And if it, you know, goes through slowly, if it goes through fast, you can figure out where the bottlenecks are because it's very tangible and concrete, right? Yeah. So how do you feel your experience in actually seeing lean flow in a physical way has helped you to be a better coach?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I just kind of, my turn to sidebar a little. I do want to say these things weren't something that I was proud of for a very long time. And so it's always surprising to me when other people are interested in it. You know, I had that same experience with Daniel Vacante, who's a big Kanban guy. And when I took his class, he also kind of geeked out for a minute. You know, when you're in it, it sucks, right? There's a reason I'm not still in it. And so that's what I was focused on, was just mostly just like, this sucks. And it wasn't until later that I started looking into the things and it really started to impact me. So I think like standardizing work is something that is really, really helpful in Agile and in anything in life, I would say. And it's one of those things that tends to become a four-letter word because it's overdone or it's done where it's not, where it shouldn't be, right? Standardized work is helpful in some instances, but we need to have flexibility when it doesn't make sense. I think the biggest thing though, is being able to think of tasks, right? Cards, PBIs, whatever they are, epics, features, stories, being able to think of them as inventory, because that's what they are. They're our digital inventory. And it's really hard because, right, they're not tangible. And we don't think about them in that way because of that lack of tangibility. But when you start thinking of, you know, like your backlog is your inventory. And then, you know, as it moves through, I'm assuming most people who are doing Agile are using a board to visualize their workflow and it's moving through different columns. Each column is kind of its own inventory. And when we talk about Kanban, building in queues to be able to see where the waste is or where the opportunity for improvement exists, it's usually not in the actual work itself, right? Like we're not asking developers to develop faster because usually that's the shortest amount of time a card has in existence. Usually it's those areas outside. It's waiting for the development. It's waiting for the handoff. And when you're able to see that with real parts and with tangible things, I feel like it just clicks a little bit better for people?
You know, I've told this story a couple of times in the past, like 2 weeks now. So I don't know if we've talked about it personally or if it's actually been in an episode of a podcast. I got to do a better job of remembering these things. But, you know, I was reading Jeff Sutherland the other day, and, you know, the story that he told about how he was doing research, right? He was doing research. And what he did was he was trying to figure out if there was a correlation between the time it took for students to get their projects done and the quality, right? And what he found was that there are some A students that need 10 times more time to get their work done than other A students who need, I guess, 10 times less or one times the amount of time to get their work done, right? And then he took that a step further and then looked at groups, right? And was looking at teams that were doing projects together. And what he realized was that that's where the greatest area for improvement was, because whereas there's only a 10x difference between the fastest A student and the slowest A student, there was like a 500x difference between the fastest A project team and the slowest A project team, right? And so like what you just said, like the idea of like focusing on, you know, how can we maximize this small unit of work, right? That we should focus on maximizing it, but the greater value are the larger aspects of the system, the larger, like the teams, the organization, the you know, the epics, right? Because you have greater ability to improve. Like if you look at an epic, right? I don't know what the numbers are, but you know, if you've got some epics that are, you know, one times and then other epics that are 500 times, right? If you could figure out what's going on there, you have a greater ability to improve your cycle time. So.
Right. Yeah. And that was one of the benefits I view to a physical board as well. Back when we were all collaborated together or co-located and were able to collaborate in person together, and we would talk about sticky notes on an actual board, it adds a tangibility to it as well.
Yeah, I remember when I was Scrum Master, I had two teams at MasterCard, and I had a rolling whiteboard that I had the team board for one team on one side and the team board for the other team on the other side. And, you know, we used Jira, right? Or no, we were using Rally at the time, right? We were using Rally, and I love Rally. I think Rally's UI is like absolutely amazing. You know, the tangible card, right? The thing that I made it into a very big moment, right? That we would celebrate when somebody would move a card, right? Everybody would stop working. I'd say, you know, let's look at the board, and that person would go up to the board and they would move it, right? And you could see it, and they're actually moving a card. So that's, you know, I do love in-person PI planning as well for that. But when I've done it in like a hybrid model where some teams are, you know, co-located and other teams are elsewhere and whatever, what I've actually done is I've set up a webcam facing the board, right? And so if we've had boards in multiple locations, because maybe we've got, you know, PI planning happening at the same time in India as we are in New York and Chicago, you know, there'll be boards in all those locations, and it's the proxy RTE in each location whose job it is, you know, I've just put this up on my board, and they, you know, ping me to let me know. And then I go over and I put it up on our board. So this way, you know, and then we put it all back into Jira at the end. So, but yeah, I love that tangible feeling of a sticky note and seeing somebody move it, or, you know, I miss the smell of Sharpies.
Yeah. Menlo has a really interesting approach to it too. They have a sheet of paper, and that's like their day. And I'm probably butchering it a little bit, 'cause I've never done it, but I've seen the presentations from them. So they have a piece of paper, and that's their day. And then they create stories or tasks or whatever the items are based off of what the clients want. And then they fold them based on their estimate of work. So if it's 4 hours, they fold it in half. If it's 8 hours, they fold the whole. If it's 2 hours, they fold it into a quarter. And once they're all folded, they give them to their client, their stakeholders, and say, you know, here are your requests. Here's your capacity, which are these sheets of paper. You know, you fill them in where you want these hours spent.
That's really cool. And what's that called again?
The company that does it is called Menlo.
Menlo. I got to look that up. That's really interesting.
Book. I think it's Joy Company is the name of the book.
Okay. I love that idea of, like, you know, with the folding of the corners and all that. It's really.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by it too. I definitely don't want to deviate probably this episode, but there is the conversation of, you know, they're using hours, right? And some people are really against that.
Right.
But it works for them. And yeah. I think that's the beauty of Agile. And those are the things that I love hearing is, like, how are these different companies doing it?
Yeah. Huh. Well, that's okay. So we got two podcast episodes that we need to write down. I'm going to write them down right now because, you know, as demonstrated earlier, my attention span and ability to retain information is absolutely next to nothing. So
yeah.
Menlo. And then now I forgot what the second one is and I didn't even say it out loud, which stinks. I think we should do a episode on hours versus story points versus whatever unit of whatever, because
I
think that that's like a great conversation. Oh, that's the other thing is I've never really understood no estimates, right? Like, and I'd like to learn more about that. Like there are these like agile concepts that, you know, I hear about, I just haven't baked in the time to learn more about it. And that's definitely one of them. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think the fascinating thing about like no estimates or what Kanban is in IT, or when people bring lean to IT, I would say that's something that I don't feel like I always agree with some of the translations that they have, but some of those concepts like throughput, workflow, all those things come from lean manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like I have a great slide that I put together deck. And a lot of it talks about the history, right? Where this all came from, because, you know, and it's told from a little bit of a, you know, it's definitely factual, right? But I put the emotion in there, right? Because, you know, to me, the fact that we had all of this time to learn about lean manufacturing, and then, you know, when you know, the first company said, all right, we need to stand up an email server or a database or whatever it is. And, you know, they were like, all right, well, how are we going to like organize this work? And they're like, all right, let's just ignore everything else that we learned about lean manufacturing. Let's call it a project and let's fund it as a cost center instead of a profit center. And, you know, so I get emotional at that part because it's like, really? Like we had all of this time to experience like lean manufacturing, the benefits of it. And, you know, voice of customer and Gemba and Pokeyoke and all of this. And it's like, all right, now we're going to go and use this thing called a project, which we put it on the rails and it just keeps on going until it goes and everybody just get behind it and push it if it gets stuck, right? Like, you know, nobody get out from behind it from pushing to go see that, you know, the rails are broken, you know? Like, yeah. let's not like, no time for introspection, no time for introspection. So, but, all right, let's get back to lean manufacturing. All right. So, so I talked about, you know, earlier, this conversation that I had with a friend, colleague of mine, you know, and they're not measuring everything. Right. And there's a little bit of pushback, right? Because, that the other thing that I always see too, as a coach is, you know, I get hired and like the idea is I'm going to make their teams agile, right? And they're going to like step back over here and observe and, you know, so, you know, this person's got a little bit of pushback with the idea of wanting to measure things that are outside of a sprint, right? At the feature and the epic level, right? The time that it takes for a request when it comes in from sales or when it comes in from the customer success group or whatever that is, right? So how would you go about, if you were a coach in a scenario where you saw that, you know, there's team level metrics at place, right? And maybe a little bit above that, right? But how, what approach would you take to coach leadership and executives for them to recognize that business agility says that, you know, we want to all be part of this as opposed to just the people holding the shovels and the rakes?
Yeah. So I'm gonna start with the consulting answer of it depends. Everything we talk about, right, is going to depend on the situation and the constraints. My go-to though is value stream mapping, which is something that comes again from lean manufacturing. I have the bound book for lean manufacturing. It's I say bound, it's like metal ring bound, like not officially published type bound book. But there's a lot of things that we can take from that when we start looking at, you know, our product or our inventory. There we go. I'm gonna say our inventory because product is a loaded thing in software development. So when we start looking at our inventory is our work items, our tasks, the things we're being asked to do, you know, where are those coming from? And being able to map all the way from there, all the way to the end. And the other thing that I see a lot too is, you know, we have this joke that a lot of us agile say is like, is it done? Is it done, done? Is it done, done, done? Because a lot of times teams are like, oh, it's out of my hands. I'm done with it. Or yeah. Is it developer done? Oh, well, it still needs to be tested. There's a lot of waste that tends to happen after a team develops it too and before they release it to production.
Well, and the holding cost of a release is tremendous, right? Like people don't like, you know, they talk about like the, you know, Apple has dialed in the perfect, you know, algorithm for their holding costs and whatnot. And, you know, the phone that you buy off the shelf today was only manufactured 3 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, whatever that is, right? But like the holding cost of a release is risk, right? It's the risk that there's going to be a collision in you know, defect that occurs by, you know, adding new code and keep on adding new code as well. So what, how have you seen that? Like what other correlations do you see? I love that you, you know, inventory, right? Like talking about this as inventory, I think is a you know, eye-opening for me as well, right? I don't know if that's something that other coaches, you know, understand like you understand, or if it's just me, or if it's that, like, you know, this might be one of those things where your background helped you to realize that you're looking at it like inventory, right? But I think that's really powerful to start looking at these work objects as inventory, you know? But what other areas do you see like that?
So I had started, I touched briefly on before it gets to the team, when we tend to talk about workflow, or at least I talk about workflow, I tend to think about what is the team doing in order to take an item from the backlog and move it to whatever their done is. And it's kind of a Jira term is where I originally got it from, because they have workflows in Jira. But there's a workflow to get it to the backlog. And there's a workflow when we think of like definition of ready to get it to ready. Yep. And so the value stream mapping points those out, but then I like to actually create boards and actually track those as well. What is the workflow at that level as well? And that gets into like lean portfolio management, which I know like Safe is really big on, is, you know, how do we manage the portfolio? I hate saying above the team, but the reality is, right, most organizations are hierarchical and it is above the team.
Yeah. Yeah. I cringe on that word sometimes as well, right? Like upstream, downstream, and
The other thing that comes to mind is unplanned work, right? Defects. You know, rework is a waste in lean, and there is rework in lean manufacturing. In fact, the guy that was next to me when I was filling parts with grease was a rework guy. He took parts that didn't process right, and he tried to see if he could fix them or break them back down to their base components to be reused again. And so they're really big on that waste, that cost. And we have huge rework issues in software development that I think go unnoticed. I call it the silent killer of development. My friend likes to call it the CO2 of software development based off of my analogy there. But what I see a lot of times is teams get stuck in these cycles of, oh, we can't develop anything new because we're constantly fixing production issues.
Yep.
And so being able to treat your production issues as also inventory and understanding not all bugs, defects, and rework are as important as others.
Yeah. One of the best coaching engagements I had was when I showed up, what I was told is, well, we can't really get started yet because for the next month and a half, the teams aren't working on anything new. They're just working on tech debt. Mm. And I was like, well, that's wonderful because now I get to point back to this to say, we never want to have this happen again, right?
Right.
What are some ways that we can, you know, ensure that this doesn't happen again or happens less frequency or frequently or happens for a shorter period of time, right? As opposed to a month and a half.
Right.
But, well, cool. So one last question I want to ask you about, and this is going back to earlier in the conversation. You mentioned the difference between, that there is a difference between lean manufacturing and Six Sigma, right? And I am a layman, right? Like I only know lean through as a secondary part of learning in all of my, you know, my training that I've taken. Like, is the difference between lean manufacturing and Six Sigma kind of like the difference between like the PSM and the CSM or between like safe and less or something like that? Or is it really night and day different?
I mean, there. So Six Sigma uses it complementary to their training and their offering, their approach. So I would say it's similar to like when people take Scrum and Kanban and put them together. So it's, you know, it's the Six Sigma in this instance would be the Scrum and then Lean would be kind of like the Kanban in that instance. I also kind of always chuckle because Kanban is a tool of Lean. So it's weird to me that it's its own thing in software development because it is essentially Lean. And I would argue in order to do Kanban well, you're doing Lean.
Yeah. But, oh, yeah. I'm getting a chuckle out of that because like I want to say that at least 8 out of every 10 engagements I've been on, there's always going to be at least one team that says that we're okay. We're not a Scrum team. We're a Kanban team. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, then you ask them a couple of questions that, you know, and you're like, okay, you're just a team that uses a Kanban board and doesn't want to be bothered with the idea of having set sprints and set, you know, sprint outcomes and that kind of level of formality. And then, you know, sometimes they chuckle and smile and like, yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah.
Leave us alone.
Gets used as an excuse to do whatever they want.
Yes. Right?
And to not have discipline. And I would argue Kanban requires more discipline.
No, absolutely. Than something like Scrum. Absolutely.
And the funny thing is it's not uncommon for me to see the same with Waterfall, right? When we talk about traditional companies that move to Scrum, right? A lot of times we say Scrum is like a flashlight. It shows you all of your dirt. And it's because there's expectations and there's rigor and there's guidelines. Whereas a lot of people, when they work in that more Waterfall situation, they have such huge like cycle times for the things they're working on that there's a lot of waste they can introduce into that cycle, especially because we're not tracking it usually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that and all of the trickery that goes into like, you know, when things go off the rails, let's, you know, rewrite things to make it seem like it's on the rails, you know, it's on the rails. It's just the rails are now broken, you know? So I'm so bitter. I am so bitter from my time as a project manager. Like, you know, for all the times that I saw my risk registers get changed and, or the times where at the end of the year, I was told, mark this project as closed and then open up a new project, give it a name that's, you know, similar, but different enough to where the steering committee isn't going to realize that we're still working on the last project. And, you know, the first couple of times around when I was asked that, you know, to do that, I was like, there's no way the steering committee is not going to realize that, you know, these 12 projects that we said we're going to get done, you know, are different from these 12 projects that have similar names. And they didn't notice. Like, I don't know how they didn't notice in those things, but I'm so bitter. I'm really bitter.
Yeah, that makes me think of another thing that I think you get when you work in a manual setting is that, like we talk about, a card isn't done, especially in Scrum, right? You don't get credit for the card until the end of the sprint. And it's not about credit. It's about actually delivering working software. Well, it's really easy to split cards and move things when it's intangible and you don't have that visibility to, is it done? Whereas when you're in a factory, a part's done or it's not.
Yeah.
You can't half assemble a mirror and be like, here's half the assembly. We're going to take, you know, we're going to ship half of it. It doesn't work.
You know, and I'm the kind of coach and Scrum Master where, like, you know, everyone's had teams that at the end of the sprint, there's stories that aren't done, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're trying to figure out, well, do some of the points go to this sprint? Do some of the points go to that sprint? Do we, you know, change the scope of the story, right? Or do we just say it's not done and it goes right into the backlog, right? Like, I'm not the kind of coach who says it has to go in the backlog. It's not done, mm-hmm. didn't meet the acceptance criteria, and it has to go in the backlog. There's sometimes that that's the right answer, I feel. But I think other times, depending on the circumstance, like allowing the team to split a story so they can get credit for some of their work is okay. And the caveat is if they're willing to sit down and talk about it in such a way to where they recognize that this is not the ideal way of working, we're going to make an exception this time around because we're going to learn from it. And, mm-hmm. you know, the next time around, you know, when we're refining our stories, we now know that these are the kinds of things in this story that we are going to call out to look for to see if they exist in future stories. You know, I think that I never want to kill the morale of my team, you know? And so if I feel like that's going to kill their morale, then all right, let's explore something else. Right. But, I don't know. How do you feel about that? Cause I mean, you can't split apart, right? You can't split a carburetor or whatever.
I have so many thoughts in this area. Some of it is when you get to the end and you're like, oh, I worked on this and I could deliver part of this, right? Like to me, that's when it's okay to split. And it's like, well, this probably should have been split to begin with, which happens.
Yeah.
But I also don't like to think of it as rigid and finite as that. That's one of the things where some of my Scrum allies may disagree with me, but when we start to get really rigid with like the beginning and the end of the sprint and that sort of stuff, and oh, you can't start work on the most valuable item because it takes longer than we have left in the sprint, that is process, right? Interaction and over building valuable software. And so we're kind of falling into those same process traps. When we think of it from a Kanban lens or a lean lens, it's all about flow. We're trying to maximize flow. And we're trying to maximize flow, hopefully, of the most valuable things. And that's how we're prioritizing. It doesn't make sense to stop the flow for an arbitrary constraint, which is the end of our sprint. Yeah. Our sprint is a reminder for us to reflect, get feedback, adapt. It's not like, you know, it's supposed to be this rigid policing policy.
That's such a great statement. And I love how you said that, right? Like I really do. I think that's fantastic. And I know I said I had one last question before, but I'm going to tack on this one last question and I'm going to give you the responsibility, the permission to, you know, afterwards, if I say, oh, I got one more question, be like, Drew, do you really need to ask this? You know, Agile is all about culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about culture. There's no process at all in the Agile Manifesto, you know, the principles and the values at all, right? What is culture like the people part of culture in Lean or Six Sigma, right? Like, you know, are you as an employee who's, you know, pulling levers or taking the turkey baster. You know, are you considered a person, a knowledge worker in most of those instances, or are you considered an extension of the machinery, you know, that is just squishy?
Yeah. This is another, it depends, right? We'll say pure lean or more of the Toyota way kind of lean, there is a foundation of psychological safety that goes a part of it. And that was something that I didn't learn in my American factory experiences. I definitely did not have psychological safety, and I definitely worked with some toxic individuals. But in lean manufacturing, they have this concept of the Andon cord, which I love, and it plays huge into the DevOps movement. Right? And it's that anytime that there's an opportunity to improve, right, they would pull this like bus cord and they would stop production in their area. And the first thing that the manager did when they came over to that person is they didn't reprimand them, which is what I think most of us would expect. They thanked them for the learning opportunity.
Yeah.
And there's this other story, I don't remember, it's like Kentucky or something. There was a Toyota shop where the Andon cords went down, right? They had less Andon cord pulls over time. And a lot of us would think, oh, that means that their quality is improving. And the general manager pulled all the staff together and they were like, listen, we have a serious problem. We're learning, right, a third less because we have these less pulls.
Yeah, that's so powerful. That's so powerful. You know, and it's funny, every time I, you know, listen to podcasts or watch videos on like the history of lean manufacturing and especially like, you know, I love the, I forget where the automotive factory was in California where Toyota came over and it was a project or an experiment to teach Americans how to work in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, my memory of the 1980s, watching movies like what's the one with the guy who was the first Batman?
Michael Keaton,
right? Like Gung Ho. I don't know if you've ever seen Gung Ho.
I don't think so.
Oh, you got to watch Gung Ho. Gung Ho is it's about that experience where the Japanese came over to teach these Americans, you know, okay. and just the clash, and it's absolutely hysterical. But you know, my recollection culturally of the Japanese auto workers back that in that time was shameful, right? Like where if you made a mistake, somebody would like ceremoniously like yell at you in front of like everybody lined up like the Empire at attention, you know, in the company, you know, and or the people who made mistakes like doing exercises and whatnot. And that's another area that I haven't like. It's like a question that I've had like, oh, wait a minute. If I remember it this way and I've seen these, and I know that a lot of it was in movies or whatever, but you know, mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen actual like documentaries on that as well in the past. If that's my recollection and this is what I know now, like I haven't actually peeled back the layers of the onion to find out like what the truth was in that, you know, because that just doesn't feel like the leadership principles that I've learned about in,
right.
You know, in lean. Like, do you have any of that recollection at all or no?
No, I don't. I mean, I haven't seen that movie. I definitely, you know, I've seen, you know, the old samurai movies where they're performing, you know, seppuku when they've made a terrible mistake. Nobody stabbed themselves in the factory on purpose when I was there because they were ashamed of what they had done. But there was definitely, so one of the things that I didn't talk about is because of my ability to be so effective and efficient in production, just kind of naturally, they had trainers at the time and they had a whole program that they sent trainers through. They basically scrapped that program. And then I was training people who were problem employees, people who were not keeping up, who weren't able to perform. I taught them my tricks and my techniques and the ways to build a part faster. Some of it was just gusto, right? You got to get a little more elbow grease in there, but some of it was, yeah, queuing things up appropriately and moving faster appropriately. And so in my experience, there definitely was, you know, some concern around pulling your weight, but it was more, as weird as it sounds, it was less about production and it was more about like your hours. Like if you were late a minute, you got a point. And if you missed the day, you got 2 points. And after, you know, 20 points or whatever it was, like you were fired. And so there was definitely much more tyranny around like you being physically present than necessarily always about your productivity.
Yeah. You know, when I first got out of the Navy, maybe about 5-6 years after I got out of the Navy, a friend of mine was, he was managing a scrum team, right? Which I know is an oxymoron, but he was managing a scrum team nonetheless. And he was talking to me about how one of his developers on his team was potentially going to get evicted from his apartment and that he can't have dinner with me tonight because he's got to help him to figure out the problem. And, you know, and I remember I said to him, I was like, why is he bringing his problems to work? Right? Like that's his thing to figure out. And my friend Mike said to me, he goes, you know, Drew, like, you know, it's not that much effort for me to lean in and help him kindly as a person. And by doing so, I'm, you know, helping to reduce his distractions at work. And, you know, he's a good employee. And I just remember, like, you know, my military background was, you know, still kind of in play at that point. But yeah. So, well, look, this has been an amazing discussion. Right. Like, and I knew it was going to be, you know, and when I thought about like this the other day, like I knew this was going to be really fascinating. I think we could love to have maybe a part two at some point down the line as well. You know, like fun facts again, behind the scenes, like 5 minutes before we actually hit the record button on this episode, we didn't know which topic we were going to talk about. And I don't even think Brad knew, like, he knew that we wanted to talk a little bit about his lean manufacturing background, but right, you didn't know that I was going to say, all right, let me interview you about this.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't like think through, you know, oh, these are the exact things that I would compare or bring up.
So, yeah.
That makes it refreshing and real.
It was good. It was really good. I think there was a lot of gold in this episode. And so, you know, like if anybody's listening to this and has questions, you know, for Brad, you know, wants to learn a little bit more. We do have the hello@agileforagilists.com email address set up. Feel free. We would love to hear your thoughts. Like, what is your experience like with working on a production line, or manufacturing line? What's your experience working on a scrum team at a company? And what questions do you have for how we can look at things as inventory, right? As a way to help better establish and understand our value stream. So I'm going to turn it to you though, real quick, for some closing thoughts, Brad. Like, what do you think? Like, what do you want to say in summation here?
Well, I guess the biggest thing, and there's definitely more stuff that I'm thinking about now that we could have gone through, and I'm sure we will eventually, but I think the biggest thing is that, you know, our history and our backgrounds are our strengths, even if we don't feel like it is in the moment.
I had no idea that's where you were going to go, but that is a powerful statement. It is a very powerful statement.
Yeah. So don't be ashamed of it. Lean into it, embrace it. And, you know, you might be able to draw a correlation that helps your company, your team, people in the world because of this background and this obscure knowledge.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. I mean, you were manufacturing. I was a U.S. Navy aviation electrician, right? Like we each have very unique backgrounds. You know, there's some coaches who are PhDs, right? There's some coaches, you know, actually I saw today on LinkedIn, there was a woman, I forget her name and I wish I can give her a shout out. Just got her CST or certified scrum trainer. And I looked at her resume and the job she's in right now is the first scrum job that she's in. And she has, I think like 10 or 15 years of being a professional cellist. And I want to reach out to her and I want to find out from her, like what she learned as a cellist that is making her a great coach, because I'm sure there's like a million things about being a cellist in a symphony orchestra that, you know, leads to being a great coach. So
definitely. Yeah. I love people with diverse backgrounds. You know, my team of people at Insight, a lot of them did not, I mean, in general, in the Agile field, there isn't a degree in Agile, right? You don't start that way. We all started as something else. But I love giving people the opportunity to switch fields, switch industries, switch positions.
Yeah.
Because I know they're just going to have that diverse angle.
That's wonderful. So, okay. So closing thoughts then, right? If you're listening to this, ask yourself the question, what is it that I've done previously in a former life that I can leverage to be a better scrum master, a better coach, a better product owner, a better product manager, tester, whatever that is, right? Like maybe you already know what it is. Maybe you don't know what it is, right? But you're probably using it even without realizing it. So pause for a moment, spend 5-10 minutes, just, you know, think about your first job out of high school or your first job in high school. Like, what was it that you learned in that job that can be brought forward here to help you to be a better Agilist? So we've already had an amazing Michael Jackson ending. This is a long, long, long ending. We've said goodbye several times. So Brad, I'm going to let you wrap it up. You can close the session.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining us for a third episode. As Drew mentioned, reach out to us at hello@agileforagilist.com with any questions, thoughts, comments. If you have a complaint, title them to Drew. All the compliments, title to Brad. And thank you for joining us.
That's not very agile. Thanks, guys. Bye.